now. It's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning. Welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Chardell, here on this Sunday morning, and I'm here with Stu Schrager, co-host and producer. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Yeah, I was on a hiatus, a little bit of a hiatus there, you know.
Well, 2 weeks ago, you informed us about the passing of your mother, mm-hmm. Merle.
Merle, yeah.
And last weekend was the... I guess the funeral or whatever, and I know I came to visit you at the wake, and I know you had a tremendous amount of visitors, and
yeah, it was much appreciated you coming by. Thank you. Yeah, we had to bring Merle up from Florida. She passed away down there, so we had her up here and she's buried with my dad, and you know, whatever. It's the life cycle, and you know, Merleo Gurleo, she had a good run. You know, she was. 92, and she had 91 good years. So last year for her was a struggle. She had some health issues or whatever, you know. But she had 91 good ones, and, you know, it's hard to hope for more than that, right?
That's for sure. And, again, I was privileged to be able to meet some of your friends and people that you grew up with, and it was interesting to get a little more insight about who the man with the bandana and the long white hair is.
The insanity of T.S., you know, yeah. Yeah, it was. I had some friends from, you know, I'm very lucky in that I still see some friends that I know since kindergarten. And, you know, Roger Vise, one of them, obviously, and John Rivera was there. Micah Pesce came, you know. So it's great to see those guys that take a little time out of their day to come and say hello. So, yeah, it was you know, kind of a, you know, it's always a melancholy, bittersweet thing, you know, when a family member passes, especially Merle. She was the matriarch, you know. She was the queen mom, you know. And so that generation, she was the last of her generation to be with us. So onward and upward, and... you know, the memories stay with you, and that's what's important, you know.
So it's interesting, the yin and yangs of life. Again, the passing of your mom, and then the ceremonies related to it. And then to move on to the better things in life, on Saturday, you had a book signing.
I did. You know, to get me, just to go back, you know, I have a hard time keeping a straight face in situations that are serious, because it's so much more funny when you're not allowed to laugh, you know. And I had a meltdown in the church at my mom's funeral mass that was like epic, to the point where my daughter was texting me from three pews back saying, "Will you please get control of yourself?" Because my brother and I completely lost it somewhere in the middle of the service.
Well, that's very interesting, because I did not make it to the funeral service, but your parting words to me in our discussion, I said, "Are you going to be talking at the funeral?" And you said, "Dad, a family took a vote and said I shouldn't," after another recent...
My brother, yeah. I eulogized my brother, and everybody said, maybe we shouldn't let him do this anymore. You know, kind of.
So I left Thursday night with that, and
well, you know, half
you're enlightening us.
Yeah, half the family wants me to do it because there's half as nuts as I am, and the other half, the serious side of the family, was don't let him anywhere near a microphone, you know. But it was funny. I won't tell you what happened. It doesn't matter what happened, but I kind of lost it, and then my brother lost it, you know. And once you lose it, you know, it's hard to come back. It's just, it's, you know, everything seems three times as funny when, you know, God's watching or whatever, you know. So we had a, you know, kind of a good time there, which I guess that's not supposed to be. But anyway, we sent Merleo off with a bang, and then we all went back to Amano and you know, had some lunch and whatever, and I had to get back to work at some point. But it was good to see the family. You know, it's a shame that those occasions are what brings everybody together, you know. But it's so, you know, my family's a little scattered. You know, my brother's in Vegas, my sister's in Florida, and my other sister's in Virginia, you know. So when you get them all together, and then their kids came with the grandkids, so it was kind of a really kind of a, you know, Merle's last, you know, bringing together of everybody. It was kind of fun to see them all, so...
So might I just ask, Why did you end up having the wake and the funeral service in the Babylon area?
Well, my mother lived in Babylon for, you know, when I guess when my brother, my younger brother, graduated high school in 73, and my parents moved to Babylon after he got out of high school. So they were there from 73, and my mother moved to Florida, I guess, I don't know, 6 years ago, whatever it was. So they were there that whole time. And my grandfather was waked there. My father was. So I think my mother just, I don't know if you can feel comfortable about where you're going to be reposing, but, you know.
No, it's funny. In all our discussions, you're always talking about Carl Place. And as your buddy said, you grew up together, but you were in Carl Place, and he was in Westbury, and, like, he lived across the street from you.
Yeah, the zip code districts were kind of funny back then. You know, I was actually a Westbury post office, but Carl Place High School, as was John, you know. And so, yeah, it's you know, the whole thing's. But Westbury and Carl Place almost kind of, they're like conjoined twins, you know. They're very close together. And, you know, if you say I came from Carl Place, people like, you know, like in Suffolk go, where's that, you know. If you say you came from Westbury, you know, everybody kind of knows it because of Westbury Music Fair, you know, the, you know, whatever, where the Roosevelt Raceway, you know, there's this, the things that.
The only thing
you had with Carl Place.
Points of interest from the past.
Right. I mean, Carl Place, you had Bill's Candy Store. You know, nobody knows what Bill's Candy Store is. You know, Head Hill, you know. Where all the potheads used to hang out, you know.
Head Hill,
yeah. So, yeah, but it was, you know, that area was fun to grow up in that area. I had a good time, you know. Interesting stuff, you know. As kids, we were mischievous, and, you know, Roosevelt Field never had a dome on it back then, you know. It was like an open-air thing, you know.
Right.
And people who aren't old enough to remember that, you know, probably find it hard to believe.
See, I was a South Shore guy, so Green Acres was where sort of hung. But it was the same thing.
Yeah.
Go back in the late 60s. It was an open-air shopping mall.
Yeah, yeah. My friends and I, we used to throw like dish bubble bath into the fountains, you know, and then and then try and run, because the rental cops that they have were all 350 pounds, so you could outrun them. It was kind of fun, you know.
So that's pretty funny, because I watched a show on Bravo, Below Deck, and that's supposedly like a cool thing to do, is to have a foam party or a bubble party or something. And
I don't know. I don't know what that, you know, I'm not a big pop culture guy, so I don't follow those trends. I'm not old fashioned. I think I'm pretty, you know, I think progressively to some degree. I don't mean politically. I just mean, you know, socially.
Well, you have to be in your line of work. I mean, being a restaurateur, you have to keep up with the contemporary likes and dislikes of the public, and presentation and ambiance and decor.
It can, but what's really weird about what I'm noticing now is this whole woke thing is getting to the point where I believe it's a little out of control, and it's kind of wormed its way into even food. Where I was looking at the James Beard Award thing, you know, and they have a literary thing, you know. You can get an award for books, this, that, and the other thing, you know. I'm thinking, maybe I'll submit my book, you know, this year's awards. But then I'm reading through what you have to do, and you have to sign this. You have to give them almost like an oral report, like you're a student, you know, about, you know, why you believe in diversity in the kitchen and this, that, and the other. And I'm looking, I'm like, are you kidding? You know, kitchens have been diverse for, you know, since I've been in them, you know what I mean? Which is 50 years, you know? But it's just this whole, you have to take the pledge. I almost feel like we're in China, where everybody has the same uniform on with the same hat, you know, and they're not going to be happy until we're all exactly alike. And I watch it even in this, there's a great show out there called Chef's Table. I'd probably get yelled at for this, whatever, but, you know, this wouldn't be the first time, so I'll just put it out there. But the first season of Chef's Table, they had all these great chefs in these great restaurants. And then it started to get woke, and they feel like they have to diversify this thing, which is fine. You know, I don't care about that. You know, there's great little, you know, ethnic places all over the place, and showcase them. But to pretend that a little barbecue place in you know, that does one thing in Philadelphia is on the same level as Le Bernardin is patently ludicrous. And we all know it. But we have to pretend pretend that it isn't, you know? And that's the part that bothers me is, like, I think we're witnessing the death of truth, you know? It's all, like, feel-good stuff, and I'm not sure that's a great idea, you know? A good dose of the truth helps you figure things out.
For some reason, that brings me to a thought that we've discussed here before. Growing up, there was, like, competition in sports and stuff.
Sure.
Like when we're in grammar school or whatever, or that's even aging. I guess they call it elementary school today.
Yeah.
But I was in discussions with one of the local sports teams.
Yeah.
And they said they have a youth development program or whatever, and it's all based on equal rewards because they don't want anybody to feel slighted.
It's so silly. It's, you know, participation trophies. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, I had there was a football coach in high school when I was there, Mr. Cody, right? And he was a rough ass guy, and you know, he won a lot of games, and they had a pretty good program, you know. And I can't picture him saying, "All right, boys, you know, the second half, let's go out there and tie those bastards." You know what I mean? It's just like, I mean, don't hit them too hard, don't make anybody cry, and let's tie them and get out of here. You know, it's bizarre.
That's what they were saying. You know, you can have a winner, but everybody gets a prize.
Yeah, what's the point? You know, and you know, in reality, the thing is, in reality, it just, you know, it evaporates under the light of truth, you know. And, you know, the bottom line is it helps you, you know, competition helps you figure out what you're good and not good at, right? Like, I had a friend, Kenny Perry. He was, you know, fastest guy in sixth grade, right? And
that sounds like a stripper I know, Candy Perry.
Kenny, not Candy. Will you keep your mind out of the gutter, please? So anyway, Kenny, you should have seen the chest on Kenny. Anyway, he was fast, you know, nobody could beat him, and you know, so he always came in first, and you can't pretend that you did. So the bottom line is, I figured, okay, maybe I'm not going to be an Olympic sprinter, you know, so maybe I'll take up the guitar, or maybe I'll paint, or so, you know, you get to figure out what you're good and bad at. I mean, if everybody thinks they're wonderful at baseball, you know, then how come I didn't get a college scholarship? I have all these trophies, but I stink, you know. It's just, it can't be any more wrong. I mean, you know, everybody wants kids to feel good, but they have to learn how to lose, because it's going to happen. You know, like I said, it evaporates under the light of truth when you get older. You know, the fact that, you know, you give Johnny a check mark because he said 1 and 1 is 7, you know what I mean? But he tried really hard, right? So you give him, fine, you get a trophy for thing of one. Now here comes Johnny, right, working for me as a waiter. He's got to add a check. You know what I mean? It's like 1 and 1 isn't 7, Johnny, and nobody's going to give you extra credit for trying, you know what I mean? You got to know this stuff, you know? It's ludicrous.
That's actually pretty funny. I guess I'll share a personal craziness with myself. I like to recycle, so I'll accumulate my bottles and cans or whatever, and then I bring them to the store.
Right.
To redeem them.
Is it the money still? I'll give you the money.
I like to think it's not the money, because, like, if I see a garbage in the street, like,
sure,
somebody
yeah.
throws a stray paper cup,
yeah,
I'm the type that picks it up and puts it
yeah,
in the garbage.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know,
absolutely.
I don't understand in a parking lot why somebody, you know, has a McDonald's lunch and then has to toss. I don't get it.
See, this is how we bring it back to food, the McDonald's lunch.
There you go. So, but what I was leading towards is when I go in, because in today's world, you put your bottles and cans into a machine, you get a receipt,
yeah,
and then you bring it in. So I batch them, I wait a while and bring it in. I happen to go to BJ's to do this.
Uh-huh.
And when I go to the customer service counter, it's very interesting to see the means by which the people add up these little receipts. There's the young people, there's no question. They get out their cell phone or a calculator, and they do each thing, you know, 5 cents plus 10 cents plus 15 cents.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Then you get some more aged people, and they'll start batching the stuff together in the sense, well, here's a 10 and a 5, so that's another 10 is 25, so here we got 25. Now we got groups of a dollar. and then there's the real old school that is just doing it in
yeah,
their head.
Long division. Yeah.
But it's like, oh, my God. And you see that. Also, I'm the type that likes to round off my change. So if somebody's giving me 95 cents change, I'll give them a nickel and get a dollar. And they get all confused.
Oh, listen, I hired a girl. She was a sophomore in college. I had a sandwich shop for about 20 minutes over in Garden City that I actually built for a girlfriend of mine who decided she'd rather be in the Hamptons for the summer than to work it. So I got stuck there, right? And anyway, so... it turns out that the electricity goes down, right? So the cash register wasn't working. Now, you get $15.95, you punch in $20, and it tells you to change and da-da-da. So the cash register goes down, so she goes, what do I do? I said, well, just give it a change, you know? She goes, well, how do I know how much change to give her? I'm like, you're a sophomore in college. This is the grand result of a participation trophy, you know what I mean? It was like, you can't be serious. You don't know how to count that back up to 20? No, I had no idea. No idea how to give change without the thing coming. I'm like, there it goes. There's the generation.
So talking about finances real quick, just to get into the phenomenon of credit card surcharge fees during COVID seem to have landed forever. It's not a temporary thing. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, because what makes a restaurant different than a traditional retail? And it's mostly in restaurants, although there are some retailers that have done this also. But it's kind of funny because I guess originally when credit cards came out, it was the fee was absorbed by the business. Now it's being passed on to the consumer, and I just curious.
Well, it's always been passed on to the consumer. It's just out front now. You know, some of this stuff is exhibitionist. I mean, you know, we charge 3%, man, for employee health care, and you know, and to make everything fair, and you know, shut up. You know, really, just do it. You know, it's the same thing when somebody puts, we're going to have a 4% credit card charge on Amex. Just do it. I think it's just the height of idiocy to put that on to purposely offend people, to tell them what a wonderful human being you are. And that's all it is, most of it. The bottom line is, you know, if you need to charge 4% more, charge 4% more right along the menu, and then nobody's mad, you know? But to put it out there is just idiotic.
Well, that's an interesting thought because, in a sense, a bank charge is like an overhead cost to the business. I'm not an accountant, but I would think that's a cost of doing business.
It is.
So you build it into your price. Pricing.
The customer pays all the bills, all of them. You know, it's not like, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, you're going to be 4%. I'm going to take 4% out and I'm going to give it to the credit card companies. It is what it is. You know what I mean? So if you're not making the profit that you need to make to cover that 4%, raise your prices by 4%.
But I'm not the smartest guy in the room. And it's only
well, thank God, there's two of us here. You know, I'm glad you said that.
But a light bulb just went on. So, credit card companies, they make money by hoping people carry a balance on their credit card.
Yes.
And they're also charging the retailer or the restaurant or the business a fee. So they're making it at both ends. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, well, they make 20-something percent on you know, on people who don't pay it. And
if
they
it
make
was
another,
only 20%, it's like 25 to 29%.
Right, and then another 4 or 5 on the credit card, you know. And then all the other stuff, if you don't pay on time, they, you know, charge. They do pretty well, you know. I said at restaurants, I should open up a credit card company, or my own government, actually. Government's even better. I mean,
the government of Tom Shawdell.
Yeah, the government has no money, and it gives it all away. It's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. Anyway, it's the credit card thing, you know, it's almost like you go into, you know, you go into the gas station, right? You have a credit card, you know, fee price and a cash price, you know, and it's amazing that they're kind of allowed to do that. Nobody thinks anything about that. But when, you know, the restaurant guy goes, hey, listen, I need an extra 4%. I just think it's dopey to put that on the menu. Just charge the 4% and shut up. The one that annoys me is the ones, you know, it's usually, I see it more in California than I do in New York, but, you know, we charge a, you know, 3% thing to you know, keep our dishwashers happy and equitable and health care for everybody, which, you know, 3% ain't getting health care for everybody, but whatever, you know. And again, just put it in there. I mean, if you're so, you know, if you're so inclined to do that, you know, to provide health care, then provide it. You know, just charge the extra money. But, you know, to expect everybody to volunteer their 3% for your thing is A, a little bit sketchy, and two, all you're doing is trying to tell everybody what a wonderful human being you are, you know. And if you're that one, I think charity should be a little on the quiet side, you know.
Well, there's definitely a discussion about that. I once heard the story that if you don't showcase your involvement, your philanthropic involvement, then you're criticized because people assume you're not. If you're boisterous and uncover what you're doing, mm-hmm. sometimes you're called a braggart. So I guess it's just in life, you know, you never can be right. There's always going to be
There's always somebody on the other side,
you.
For sure.
But you know, just going back to that pricing thing for a second, I find it interesting, and I kudos to Bola that they have those convenience stores and markets and gas stations. If you use a debit card. When you purchase gas, they give you the cash price,
right.
Which is cool. I'm not sure if Speedway does it, but I know Bola does it, and that's pretty cool because there's a lot of places that it doesn't matter if you use a credit card or a debit card, unless you give them green.
Yeah, they'll take it.
You don't get the price, and it's sometimes it's 10 cents a gallon, which, you know, in the course of one fill up isn't a lot of money. But for somebody that might fill up every day or whatever, it's crazy. And sometimes, again, in today's world, for business convenience, if somebody has a fleet credit card for his drivers to go out and get gas, well, it doesn't make sense for him to give everybody cash. So he's, again, paying 10, 15 cents a gallon more. And before you know it, it's...
No, it's a lot of money. I see it even with the deliveries in a restaurant. You know, we have the gas, you know, charge. Fuel surcharge, you know. And it's funny because when... Now, fuel is down, you know what I mean? But the surcharges are the same. You know, it's like, once you establish a tax or a way to take money from somebody, it never goes back the other way, you know? It's forever.
I learned that early in my business career. When I graduated from Syracuse, I went to work in a family business. It was a vinyl manufacturing business. We did office products and school supplies and artist, those big portfolios that the artists carry. But all of it was based on vinyl, and it was all the pricing for the sheet film that we would buy was petroleum based and whatever volatility of the cost of gas. And when there would be a gas shortage or prices would go up, our prices would go up also. And again, just I guess like in any business, you know, you have a catalog and you have a price list, and that's based on the cost of the time. And then all of a sudden, prices go up and you have to have a supplemental price list or whatever.
Yeah.
But what I learned over the years was usually when these prices would go up and then the gas prices would fall, the vinyl manufacturers, the sheet film manufacturers that we purchased, they never lowered the rate if we bought it by, usually I guess we were buying by the pound, it never went back down. It sort of had a new minimum ceiling.
Nobody ever gives it back, you know what I mean? So listen, I got to tell you a story about...
Well, let's take a break.
Okay, we'll do that.
We'll come back. Actually, maybe we even might talk about some food.
That's...
But whatever your thought was, just remember what you were talking about. But I also want to talk about the book signing, which I was so disappointed that I missed.
All right, we'll do both when we get back.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a wine produced by a family of German-speaking Italians from the Alto Adige. This region is home to another famous Santa, Pinot Grigio, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up your bottle of Santa Giada Pinot Grigio at Stu Leonard's Wine in Farmingdale and Ryan's Wine in East Meadow. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
All right, so which one you want to do first here? Should we do book signing first?
So I don't mess you up. I don't know what the thought you had.
Oh, no, you go first. Yeah, it's fine. Okay. Yeah, you're the producer. You're the big guy.
Would you share about your book signing? I got detoured, as my life does, and I guess you had your book signing in Wading River.
Yeah, at Wines by Nature.
Who we had as a guest once.
Yeah, George Eldy. He's a real good guy, and he used to sell me wine for a long, long time. He opened a restaurant in Glen Cove for a while with a friend of his, and I guess he wound up selling it or whatever, and back into the wine business, you know, was, I think he was a rep for, I want to say, Wildman or whatever, one of the bigger companies. Anyway, George, good guy, learned guy, knows a lot about wine, and then decided to open up his own shop, and he did in the, I guess it's called the Shops at Eastwind,
yes,
by the Eastwind Caterer there. It's a nice little center, beautifully done. I mean, it looks like a little New England village, you know, and they got a carousel for the kids, you know, it's a nice place. So anyway, I asked George if he would carry the book when I got it, and he said he would. He said, but let's do a signing, too. And it turns out I can't get books until November because of the supply chain stuff. You know, we're on our way to be in Venezuela here, so we can't get anything until November. And it's kind of interesting because the book came out in July, August, September, October. You know, I'm talking about 4 months to get the books, where it usually takes an hour, you know. And the funny part is you can get it on Amazon, or you can get it on Barnes & Noble or iUniverse, you know, my publisher. But yeah, they can't, for some reason, I can order 50 on the internet and get them, but I can't get 100 out of it. The whole thing is so bizarre. Anyway, so, I'm turning into my Aunt Pauline, and I'm losing the plot here. But it turns out that we had a signing last Saturday, and it was a lot of fun. We had about 35, 40 people there. I gave a little quote-unquote talk, you know, about the restaurant business. I had a little question and answer session, you know, which was kind of fun. And I'm actually doing the same thing Tuesday night at the Smithtown Historical Society. We're going to turn that into the Smithtown Hysterical Society. And we're going to have a lot of fun up there. I'm going to be signing books.
But will you have the addition, I mean, part of the allure of coming out to see you was, I think you had Wolfer Estates pouring some wine.
Yeah, Wolfer and Roanoke both poured wines.
Will there be anything like this at Smithtown?
No, it's not a wine shop, you know. So, and I brought some snacks, which was kind of fun. That won't be the case at Smithtown. You're going to have to eat before you get there and tie a package on if that's what you want to do before. But, yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, there's a bunch of reservations up there, and tickets are going pretty well. So if anybody wants to stop by, it's Tuesday night at 7 o'clock at the Smithtown Historical Society.
So I want to share an email we got from Larry Feldman, somebody that came to visit you.
I met Larry, yeah.
It goes, "Hi, Stu and Tom. My wife, Betty Ann, and I had the pleasure of meeting Tom at last Saturday's book signing. He was terrific, regaling participants with a few hysterical tales about Shorty, and my favorite, when a customer in his Montauk restaurant told Tom that he knew Tom Shordell and was going to call him, complain, and get him fired. During our brief conversation, I asked Tom if he'd be interested in cooking at our Long Beach Soup Kitchen fundraiser, which is coming up." And it goes on to say that you said to reach out to us. It then goes to say what... P.S. We really enjoyed meeting George and Chris at Wines by Nature. Loved the selection and the time George took to make suggestions. We purchased a terrific mixed case as a result, including bottles from Roanoke Vineyards and Wolfer Estates, which were featured Saturday. We'll be stopping by whenever heading to the North Fork. Thanks again.
Nice. All right. Well, that's, you know, that's a great example of symbiotic, you know, relationships between, you know, chefs and or restaurant people and wine shops, you know, whatever. I mean, that's great when both, you know, I mean, they bought a book, which was good for me. They bought some wine, which was good for George. So it's one of those things that finally worked out. You know what I mean? It doesn't always, but
it seemed like the perfect... the perfect afternoon. I don't remember what the weather was like.
It was terrible. It was raining like crazy.
But again, it was from 1 to 4 out there.
Yeah.
And I went to Boy Scout camp in Wading River, so I was actually looking forward to getting out there. And it hurts me that much more when I hear that you sort of gave a speech.
Yeah, it's more like a talk, you know. I do some reminiscing. I tell some stories. You know, I have this whole dog and pony show that I do at these tastings at these signings. And it's a lot of fun. You know, people get a chance to, you know, see the inside of the restaurant business from my book experiences and stuff. And I also, you know, I do a question and answer period for half an hour, so people have, you know, thoughts or questions about, you know, it's funny. One guy said, you know, who cooks in a restaurant when you're not there? I said, the same people who cook when I am. You know, thing, you know, but it's kind of a fun thing, a fun back and forth thing. And, you know, I think the people who show up have a good time. I certainly have a good time doing it. So
it was actually, again, a great week to have the book signing. Again, you had, you know, your whole family around and stuff. But there was also an article, a feature article in Newsday.
Yeah, Erica, you know, she's been a, you know, a friend and a colleague over the years. I mean, you know, she's obviously, you know, a newspaper friend. I mean, I know her through Newsday. She's a writer for Newsday. So she did an article on me going, you know, transitioning from restaurants to country club cooking, and also on the book, Second Helping, which, you know, we should do a second hour, and we could have Playing with Fire, and then we could have Second Helping, Stu, you know.
Sounds, I mean, like a plan.
Yeah, just lobby the, so I have a hard enough time getting to this one. You know?
Wait, let's dig into that for a second. So, you know, go forward 6 months. We have these two programs. We have Playing with Fire and then Second Helping. So what would be the subject matter for Playing with Fire? It certainly wouldn't be about food, because we never get there.
No. Well, we do that, and then the Second Helping, we just replay the same show. You know what I mean? It's a second shot at it. You know,
that's corporate America today.
There you go. You know, it's like a surcharge. It's like a fuel surcharge. So anyway, I want to tell you, getting back to restaurants, which is an unusual event for us. I got to tell you about an experience I had, and I won't tell you where it was because it doesn't matter. But I'm very familiar with the location and where the place is, right? So it's a new restaurant, just opened up a couple of weeks ago. So I said, all right, let's go, you know. So I'm going to go over there. So I get there, and I'm watching, you know, I'm a keen observer of what goes on in restaurants because I know them intimately, and I'm very, very versed in, you know, what happens from start to finish in a restaurant experience. And, you know, I'm also a student of the game, so I'm always looking to see things that maybe I haven't seen before, that somebody has a different idea on, that I can expand to my own repertoire, and things that they do that are horrific that I'll never do again, you know, kind of. So it's always a learning experience. So I go in, and I'm a bar eater, right? And I like to eat at the bar. So I ordered this bottle of Gavi, Principessa Gavi. It's Banffy. And whenever, first let me tell you that the wine list is ridiculous. It's awful in the sense that there's like 14 Pinot Grigios, you know, 19 Chardonnays. And the champagne list is just hilarious. You know, they have, you know, two champagnes that are in that 50, 60 range, I guess 70, whatever, Prosecco. And then they have Dom Perignon. Like, they have a vintage and a non-vintage for $350 and $550, right? And they have all these big, big, you know, California Chardonnays that nobody's going to order at $225, $230. A Sassicaia, which is a very expensive Italian wine in the $500 range, you know. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, nobody knows what's going on here, you know. So anyway, I find this Gavi. It's in the $50, $60 range, whatever it was. And it's only because I couldn't find another wine that I liked. It was just, the list was, in my humble opinion, awful. It was out of balance. It was crazy expensive, half of it, you know. The other half was terrible. Anyway, so I ordered this Gavi, right? And so about 20 minutes later, the guy comes up with the wrong bottle of wine, right? So I'm sitting there for 20 minutes. He comes up. He's got this other Gavi. And no, that's not the one. Oh, okay. Let me go find it. So he goes down to get the second one. And now he brings this. He doesn't bring the second one up. He brings another one up and says, we don't have the first one that you ordered. All right, well, then let me change. I don't want that one. Let me change. So I wind up ordering this Pinot Grigio from Yerman, which is a pretty good vineyard in northern Italy, in Venice, you know, Veneto area. So now he goes down, and it's another 15 minutes. I'm there, got to be 45 minutes with nothing to drink, and I'm starting to simmer a little bit, you know. So now the guy comes up with four bottles of wine, right? like for me to choose from the four bottles. And he's got the one I ordered. He's got two others that I didn't order. And he's got the one that I originally ordered, which wasn't Pinot Grigio, right? So this is like a Fawlty Towers episode. So anyway, I said, no, that's the original one. That's the one I want, right? So finally get that. So now we're going to order dinner, right? So, you know, they're out of this, they're out of that, they're out of the other thing. I don't, well, why don't you tell me what you do have, you know? Tell me what you do have, because I'm easy. I don't care. I can eat anything, right? So I ordered this, that, and the other thing comes out. And I ordered, they have a dish on the menu that's got a lot of truffle thing going on. But it was a stuffed pasta. It was a cappelletti, right? With truffle this and truffle that and truffle the other thing. MP, market price. You know, there's no price on the menu. So I said, all right, give me one of those. I feel like having a little stuffed pasta, right? So stuffed pasta comes out, and it's not stuffed pasta. It's fettuccine, you know? Now, the bartender is totally in the weeds. She's, and it's not busy. She's spinning, you know. As soon as people start, you know, spinning, you know, they're in trouble, right? Can't figure out what's going on. And I said, you okay back there? She goes, yeah, it's my first day, you know. I'm thinking nobody trained her, you know. It's like crazy, right? So I felt bad for her anyway. I said, listen, I don't really want to complain about this, but this isn't what I ordered, you know. I ordered the cappelletti. She says, oh, that is the cappelletti. Honey, I know what cappelletti looks like. That ain't it. You know what I mean? So I said, trust me on this. It's not cappelletti. You know, go just see if we can get the cappelletti, right? So she comes back about 10 minutes later and she goes, we don't have the cappelletti. That's the way they're serving it. I said, well, okay, well, that's not what I ordered. And I, you know, I don't really want the fettuccine. So she says, oh, you don't want it? No, I don't want it. You know, okay, let me talk to a manager. So I see the manager because, you know, like I said, I know what's going on. And I got him pegged as the manager. He's walking around with an old-fashioned glass full of booze, you know, and yapping with his buddies or whatever, you know, an old thing. So I see her lean over the bar to talk to the manager, and the manager's looking down at me because she obviously said the guy at the end of the bar, you know, he's got a problem with the fettuccine, whatever. She's looking at me, and I'm expecting him to come down. And I'm not going to say anything about the whole experience. All I want to do is, can I either get the cappelletti or take this off? I don't want it, right? So he, instead of coming down, he's too busy drinking, right? So he, instead of coming down, he dispatches a hostess to me, right? Now, the hostess is about 12 years old, so she comes up to me, and she goes, is there a problem, sir? Yeah, it's been a problem for about an hour and a half, you know? So I said, I ordered the cappelletti, and I got the fettuccine. I didn't really want the fettuccine. She says, well, how about I get you a ravioli? How about you just take it off the check? You know what I mean? It's like, I'm telling you, it was like an episode of F Troop. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody's been trained. Finally, they took it off. And she said, you know, can I get you another bottle of wine? I said, no, it's 9:30, you know, and I probably won't get it before midnight. So I think I'll pass. Anyway, I 6 months maybe I give them. This is the most ill-run place I think I've been in 20 years. And, you know, it just kind of reinforces the the belief in me that service is probably a little more important than food in a restaurant experience, because I don't think great food will ever rescue a bad service experience, but I think great service can rescue a mediocre, you know, food experience. Because you go in and say, all right, I had this hamburger. It was, you know, I ordered a medium rare and it was medium, you know. But the waiter was fun. He came out. He did this, the dad. He gave me a dessert on the house. You know, we had a glass of wine, whatever, you know. I've never heard anybody go, you know, the waiter couldn't get my food out. Or we waited 45 minutes for the appetizers came out. They were great, but, you know, nobody just, you know, relishes an experience in a restaurant where the service is terrible. And somebody said to me, there was another guy complaining at the bar about something else. Everybody was unhappy, you know. And I remember thinking that, you know, like, wow, these guys don't know what they're doing. It's a complete mess here. And then somebody later, subsequently, a day or two later, told me, yeah, I know those guys. They're contractors. They've never been in a restaurant business before. And I'm like, well, you'd never know it. You know, I mean, it was the second most disastrous. I'll tell you about the most disastrous experience if we have time. But, yeah, it was completely out of control. it turned into a comedy for me. I wasn't even mad. I was just giggling after a while. I was just watching these poor people. You know, you throw a bartender back behind a bar without any training whatsoever and no help. You know, it's not like she was back there with another guy who, you know, who worked a shift before or had an idea what he was doing. She was just on her own and drowning, you know. And it was funny, but it was sad to watch. You know, I was laughing not at her. I was laughing at the experience, you know.
Well, that's always an interesting scene to me. You know, the bartender is really there mixing drinks. And then it's funny. I'm going to read to you an email that we got from one of our listeners about eating at the bar. You could actually explain it more than I, but is it usually the bartender's responsibility to go into the kitchen to bring out the food, or they have somebody?
No, there's usually a runner.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, so when the bartender is behind the bar, you know, they're sort of encapsulated.
Well, that's why you eat the bar.
And what do they really know about the food?
Well, they should know everything about the food like any other server in the place, you know? I mean, how can you know... That's the thing about country club waiters. I mean, I've been, you know, schooled in the fact that country club waiters could care less about what the food's about, you know. And it's sad because, you know, I sit there and bang my head against the wall trying to, you know, educate them, and they just refuse to be educated, you know. And there's some people that don't train their staff. You know, I said to her, she goes, "Can I get you something to drink?" I said, "Well, what you got?" She says, "Well, we have everything." I said, "Okay, well, how about wine? What do you have? You have a list?" "Oh, no, we don't have a list." I said, "What do you have?" "Well, we have the usual stuff like Cabernet and Merlot." I'm like, "Well, all right, do you have any white, any pink, you know, is there a name, is there a year?" You know, I didn't want to beat up on this kid because she's, you know, she's thrown to the wolves here. And then I said, "You don't have a list?" She says, "Well, we do, but by the bottle." Well, I'm okay with a bottle. You know what I mean? It's like, just give me the list, you know. Give me an idea. Help me out here. I'm trying to buy something.
So it's funny. you talk about your preference to dine at the bar.
Yeah.
So Tom C., one of our loyal listeners, wrote in, and he says, "Pam and I went to Madrian, is that the name of the, how you say it?
Madrian.
Madrian, this past Sunday. This time we sat at the bar and had some appetizers with a glass of wine for each. Then we had dessert. The biscotti was so nice I had to have a glass of red wine for dunking the biscotti."
Nice.
"Mm, thanks for the recommendation." So I, knowing a little bit about Tom Shordell, and I took the liberty of responding on our behalf, and I write to Tom, "So very glad that our listeners act on our suggestions. I always enjoy sitting at the bar enjoying small plates or appetizers, enjoying an interesting flight of wines. Biscotti with a glass of wine beats dunking in my cappuccino for sure. As always, we appreciate your interactions with us as well as your enjoyment of our show." So, Pam and Tom from Levittown, thank you very much.
Nice. Thank you much. Yeah. And, my suggestion though, next time, Tom, if you want a really cool experience, dunk your biscotti in like a glass of Vinsanto, which is a dessert wine from Italy. And that's the key, man. I love that stuff. It's a little sweeter, obviously, than red wine. I mean, red wine's great, you know, with anything. But Vinsanto and biscotti is the classic pairing, you know, from Italy.
Is it like a thick syrupy type wine, or
it's not syrupy, but it's definitely sweet. It's an amber color, you know, like a dark amber color. You know, it's just beautiful, great stuff. But it's great. I appreciate the people listening. And Mandrian, you know, I was there once, and I was impressed by the wine list. She's the woman who owns it is very schooled in what she's doing, and her wine list is fabulous. You know, she does a great job. And it the only reason I haven't been there more often is because it's kind of like flyover country for me. You know, I don't really get that way much. You know, I'd have to really make
a
trip.
Where is it?
It's
in
Setauket, Stony Brook, up that way, you know.
Gotcha.
I think it's Setauket. It's right across where that place Mario's used to be. That's got to be Setauket.
Well, there's a lot of Mario's.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that Mario. Anyway, She opened up, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago now, I guess it's been. And I stopped there on my way back from out east one time, made a specific trip up there. But most of my, you know, traveling, I mean, I do more miles on the LIE than anybody I know. I'm constantly going back and forth and to make that detour all the way up there. Plus, I don't trust myself to behave because the wine list is so good. You know, I need a driver to get there and back, you know. But, hey, anybody in that area, man, that's... And the food was good, too. We had a couple of things. I don't remember exactly what it was, but we had some small plates, and they were good. But the wine list was exceptional. It's one of the better ones that I've seen on Long Island.
So I think we need to take another break, but before we do, I just want to shout out some kudos to Frankie over at Westbury Manor. The Polo Lounge was there with a bunch of people the other night on Thursday night, and the place was really, really cooking. There was a really nice crowd, people around the bar. They have this huge horseshoe-shaped bar, and there's some sort of tables on either side of that, so like in the bar area, and then they have the regular dining room. We left all the ordering to Frankie, and it was a great array, anything from steak to a veal chop, some gnocchi. I have to find out, he was serving this wine, this Cabernet, that was incredible. Just four of us, and I think we did three bottles. It just went down so smooth.
Was it California or?
I believe it was, but for an update next week. But just again, thank you, Frankie, for a great evening. And again, if anybody wants a really nice restaurant for, it doesn't have to be a special moment, but it really lends itself to that. You know, if you want to just enjoy old time service and ambiance and be catered to, the Polo Lounge at Westbury Manor is definitely the place to go.
I haven't been there since it's Carl Hopples, so I mean, you know, I'm going back to probably the late 60s, you know. I got to stop in. I got to check it out.
So I think I believe they're only serving from Thursday to Sundays, but in the Polo Lounge. Again, great place to stop.
Cool.
So anyway, let's take another break.
All right.
And we'll be back. I have some food-related things to ask you.
I can't believe it. Come on. 44.
Okay, that's good.
All right, when you're ready.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
I think our tagline should be lifestyle, wine, and food, because we always get to food eventually, you know, which we're supposed to be talking about.
So I want to throw a couple of things at you and get your insight.
I hope your aim is
so
good.
What's the deal with serving butter in a restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
Is it not upscale to serve pats of butter in silver foil?
I wouldn't do that personally. I think there's places, you know, you go to a diner, you kind of get that thing, and that's fine for them, you know. I mean, it's portion controlled, and they can kind of keep a handle on it. Plus, it's easy, you know. It's easier for people. So I think that in certain situations, it's acceptable, you know. You go to a diner or you go to a pub or something like that, I don't think anybody cares. You know, on my level, and I don't mean that condescendingly, I'm just talking about upper echelon restaurants, you know, you can't do that. It's just, it's cheesy looking, it's terrible, you know, you don't do that.
And in general, when you're serving butter, what's the consistency? I mean, should it, again, many times when you get the pads of butter, again, in the gold or silver wrap, it's frozen.
Yeah, it's hard as a rock, yeah, of course.
And not the most fun to put on your bread or roll.
Mm-hmm. No, it should be spreadable. I mean, you know, when you serve butter in a crock or whatever, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, right out of the refrigerator, because then you got to dig it out with a knife or whatever and, you know, take thin slices and kind of place it on your roll or whatever. It's not good. So it should always be a spreadable, you know, consistency, I think, you know. And it's not hard to do. You know, you just take it out in advance a little bit and, you know, warm it up. It's fine. But to have hard butter in any capacity, I mean, even if you're going to do the continental, what they call continental butters, which are the foil wrap butters, or even worse, the little one that comes on the cardboard thing, you know, the one. I mean, it's just awful.
But that's classier to me than coming in a silver wrap, but that's just
Well, the wrap, you know, the reason people use this the wraps is you can reuse the butter.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so that's the you know.
So now, as somebody that's preparing a menu and the whole effort of appealing to the patrons of the restaurant, I enjoy many times that to get like a whipped butter or whatever, and usually it's pressed in a way that is, it looks good. I mean, it might be in a flour
or a rosette,
or whatever,
yeah,
a rosette. Then there's also the question of salted butter or unsalted butter. I don't know if there's a
I use exclusively unsalted butter, and you may want to ask me the reason.
I do.
All right. Well, I'll tell
Pray
you.
Pray tell, as they say.
Yeah, right. The reason is that salt is a preservative, and when you have salted butter, you don't know when it goes rancid on you, because the salt keeps it, you know, barely breathing for a long time. With unsalted butter, you know right away when it's if it's good or bad, you know. And it very rarely is bad because you use so much of it. In the restaurant, I use so much of it, it turns over pretty quickly. But you don't know how long it's been stored at the purveyor, you know. So when I get it in, you know, unsalted butter, if it's shot, you know, will manifest itself in that regard. And that's the reason. And the other thing is, too, I mean, it changes ever so slightly, but it does. It changes your recipe formulas for, you know, whatever sauce you're making or whatever you're using the butter in. If there's salt in it, then you obviously got to add a little less salt to the finished product. And if there's no salt, then you have a clearer vision of how much salt should be in there. So I think for all those reasons, and they're subtle and they're small. Look, there's a lot of restaurants that use salted butter and they're fine, you know. I choose not to do that, only it's personal preference. And the reasons I gave you are the reasons why. And that's pretty much the long and short of it, you know.
And then just to continue briefly, though.
On the butter.
And what about flavored butters?
Or
spreads that...
Yeah, they're fine. I mean, you know, I think they're interesting. You know, it can be. You know, I know restaurants that'll serve three different flavored butters, a plain, you know, let's say a sun-dried tomato and a garlic or something like that. And it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, just a preference that people have. I'm a little more of a purist. I won't do that for bread. I think that, you know, if you want to make a spread, I mean, there's a buddy of mine has a place, fabulous little restaurant out in Smithtown, St. James, actually, called Trattoria. And he sends out, you know, like three little spreads for your roll. You know, one's, I think, a sun-dried tomato, one's a flavored ricotta, and the other one's butter-based or whatever. I don't remember offhand. But it's a nice little touch, you know?
So when you talk about a nice little touch, though, when that's done, don't you think that the server should say what each of the items are?
Absolutely.
So that's interesting to me, because there's a couple of restaurants I go to that they do serve a spread. One does three different things. I might even be... a dipping oil or whatever is one of them, but right. You know, at least enlighten the patron to what it's all about.
You know, the information part of service is what really gets me, because, you know, they're in such a big hurry to tell you what their name is and they're going to be a server tonight. I want to kill myself every time I hear that. But first of all, I don't mean this in a lousy way. I don't really care what your name is. You know what I mean? And you know, I had a feeling you were going to be my server. It's the apron and the pen. You know, it was a dead giveaway, right? So, okay, now I got that information. Well, how about the prices on the specials? You know, some people never give you the prices of the specials. Some people never tell you what the butter is. I mean, that's the information that's critical to the dining experience. Not my name is Joey and I'll be your server tonight, you know. Could you please pass me a pistol, you know?
So I have a presentation to make to you.
Really?
One of our listeners dropped by last week, Bill O'Leary, and he dropped off a butter bell crock for each of us.
Really? Thank you.
And I'm not quite sure how it works, but apparently it's you put the butter in there, you put some water, and the butter bell Crock keeps the butter smooth and spreadable.
Wow.
Which is a good thing.
It's a great
especially
thing.
And he was joking because I guess way back when I must have made a comment about Passover, which is in April usually,
sure, yeah.
About trying to spread the frozen hard butter on my matzah. It doesn't work too
no,
well.
No, it crumbles in your hand. And tell him, listen, ask him, or write him back and ask him if he has another 200 of those. I could use them in restaurants, you know.
There you go. There you go. So my other comment to you is we just had the season of the Jewish holidays.
Right.
Rosh Hashanah was the middle of September, and then this past week was Yom Kippur, which is the holiday where Jews, many Jews at least, actually fast.
Right.
I'm the luckiest guy around. My mom is a phenomenal cook, she still keeps it going. In her prime, she would do, as many of the Jewish holidays are, they're two-day celebrations.
Sure.
And she's opted to go well out for one of
one
the
day.
Two.
One day, yeah, yeah.
But incredible spread that was prepared, anything from turkey and brisket, her homemade chopped liver, noodle pudding, and kasha.
I mean, love kasha.
Okay, so here's the dilemma in today's world. So mom says, this is your list of what I need to get for the holiday.
Right.
And I need to get some bow ties for my kasha.
Sure.
So I go to
That's the varnitschkes part.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So I go to the store, and I go into the pasta section, and I get bow ties.
Yeah.
She goes, Stu, this is the stuff that has the semolina in it. I need egg noodles. I said, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. So then I go back to the store, and lo and behold, there's no bow ties.
Really?
And then, I'm not
there's
exaggerating.
A run on bow ties.
I went to like six different stores.
Good son.
There's no bow ties. So I'm like going like, I don't like to be, I like to be the guy that comes through.
Sure, yeah.
So I'm really struggling. And at one store, I find these like, they're like cut out bow ties.
Yeah, yeah.
It's I guess they're meant to go like in split pea soup, as my mom says. Oh, those are the ones I use in the split pea soup. Not in the kasha.
Get a bow tie menu.
So I go to another store, and there's a big sign. Due to the shortages at the Manischewitz manufacturing facility.
They can't get workers.
We're out of grains. We're out of the kasha.
Call off the holidays.
You know? It's just crazy. So, you know, I'm not the smartest guy, but, you know, I go to pick up some of the other missing entrees or components of my mom's meal. So I go to Ben's. I love their compote and I guess gravy. That's another story for we got to talk about gravy because apparently many people serve meat gravy on turkey, which I don't understand.
No, yeah,
we'll get to that.
That's ridiculous.
But at any rate, I figured out that, you know, I go to Ben's and there's a whole tray of kasha.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, if I can't get my bow ties next time and mom wants to make her kasha, not the Ben's kasha,
yeah, yeah.
I can at least get the bow ties, hopefully, from, you know, either Ben's or pastrami,
yeah, yeah.
or whatever. But who knew that there's pasta shortages?
Oh, yeah, I know. It's crazy. It's everything. But kasha is one of my favorite foods. It's buckwheat groats. That's what they are. It's kind of like a farro, but it's made of buckwheat, you know. And you got to handle it differently. The grains, you have to take an egg mixture and mix it in the egg mixture. Otherwise, it's sticky. It sticks together.
You usually saute with like some onions or something, right?
You do. You saute the onions and you cook it like rice. But if you don't coat it in the egg mixture, you have a mess on your hands. You know, you'll take the whole thing out with a spoon.
And Tom Shordell goes home. He makes himself a portion of kasha. How do you serve it to yourself?
I don't really do it at home, but I would do it with like a turkey gravy. You know, I have it at Ben's. That's pretty much where I go for it. But I did the whole breakfast thing the other night at the club. I made noodle kugel. I made matzo ball soup. I made brisket and turkey. And, you know, we did omelets and things like that. Some grilled vegetables. It was a lot of fun.
I've experienced it all in my life. I've broken fast at a Chinese restaurant or do the Jews call appetizing, which is smoked fish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, like tuna salad.
Sure,
and salad,
yeah, yeah. We did
whatever.
That, yeah.
But then, again, so in another time, we have to talk about gravy because of this turkey thing, but also this thing called bagels, because that's a whole other thing, because there's a there's people that are making rolls that they call bagels.
Oh, yeah. No,
and
I
we
know.
Need to talk about this.
All right.
Well,
next week. All right. So we've come to the place where we always get to, the end of the show. And I want to close the show out with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which are, as usual, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life as important as pizza. And next week, we'll talk about gravy and bagels. See you then.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a wine produced by a family of German-speaking Italians from the Alto Adige. This region is home to another famous Santa Pinot Grigio, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up your bottle of Santa Giada Pinot Grigio at Stu Leonard's Wine in Farmingdale and Ryan's Wine in East Meadow. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients: Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming, personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.